Thinking about some of those questions made me remember an interview Steve did a couple of years ago with a Norwegian journalist named Asna Sejersted. In 2011, white supremacist and neo-Nazi Anders Breivik killed 77 people. Most of them were teenagers he gunned down on an island summer camp in Norway. Well, today he's in prison and completely unrepentant. And Asna spent years interviewing, researching, and getting to know him. She says that while it's tempting to think of Breivik as a monster, he's also one of us, which is the title of her book.
He was born like one of us, typical in many senses. And then at some point, he decides to go against all of us. It would be too easy to say, you know, he is ill, he's sick, he's mean, he's evil, he's not one of us. When you go through his life, you see that he's actually quite normal. It's normalcy that strikes you.
Hmm. So even though he committed this horrible atrocity, I mean, you know, killing 77 people, you do not use the word evil to describe him.
Oh, his actions are definitely evil. And I think, yes, he's evil. I think you could say that about him. But none of us are born evil. That does not exist. When does he become a terrorist? When does he become evil? That's an interesting question.
Yeah. Well, we should just briefly sketch the outlines of his early life. I mean, as you say, he had a pretty miserable childhood. I mean, his father basically abandoned him when he was very little. He grew up with an unstable mother, I mean, probably mentally ill, never really fit in, and was wanted to fit in, but just couldn't for whatever reason, and just seemed to become an extreme loner.
Yeah, and there's so many, unlucky combinations in his life. Because, yes, he had a bad childhood, but it's like, I'm sure you have millions of children in the world who have much worse childhoods than him.
Right, who don't become murderers then, yes.
Yeah, exactly. So what makes a man commit evil actions like that? Probably something genetic. He has a history of mental illnesses in the family. Then it's definitely the lack of a father. And that's also interesting when you see many of the terrorists, the Islamic terrorists, the foreign fighters going to Syria. That's one unifying factor, a lack of a father. So then it's the instability at home, unstable mothers, if we can, you know, talk in headlines here a bit. So she has this love-hate relationship to her son. I love you, I hate you, I wish you were never born, I want to give you away, I want to give you to, you know, foster care. And then in the next moment, she would hug him. They would sleep tied together at night. So definitely that is a bad start. And then there's something about him that makes him not be welcome. In his childhood, he reshapes himself and he remakes himself so many times to try to fit in there, in that gang with
right, these he tries to join various groups, and they always end up rejecting him. And eventually, as a young man, then he basically just goes off and spends years playing video games like World of Warcraft and Call of Duty.
Yeah, he tries to find a place to belong. He's rejected because there's something about him that people just don't, you know, they don't want him around. There's something. And then he loses his money because he desperately wants to become rich, because he wants to be admired. He wants to be seen. He wants to be something big. He wants his father, who saw him occasionally every summer holiday. But after he was 15, he never saw him again. He didn't want to see his son. So Anders Breivik was going around telling his friends, if I did something really great, something really big, maybe my father would see me.
One thing that's striking is in some ways how similar Anders Breivik is to the people he detests. I mean, the kinds of people who would go join Al-Qaeda, for instance, who've also committed brutal murders. I mean, it's the outsider who feels rejected by society, who feels isolated, and then looks for a grand cause and has violent fantasies that will bring him glory.
Yeah, and it's true that all extremists resemble. They have the same worldview of dividing us and them, good and bad, this wanting to cleanse, this wanting to purify the world or the caliphate, or in Anders Breivik's case, in his manifesto that he wrote, to purify Europe from all Muslims and all Muslim influence.
You said that the interesting question is when he became evil. I mean, he wasn't born that way. He committed these horrible acts. I mean, arguably the biggest trauma in Norway since the Second World War, since the Nazi occupation.
Yeah, it's probably, even though I posed the question myself, it's probably the wrong question, because he doesn't see himself as evil. He sees himself as doing good, just as the Islamists in ISIS and in Syria would say. He sees himself as a savior. But when does that start? I think it comes quite late. So slowly he's going on to the even darker sides of the internet, which is the fascist sides, the white supremacist sides and the neo-Nazi sides and anti-immigration, anti-Islamist sides and so on. And he, of course, again, he wants to suck up to the leaders as he's done all his life trying to be a member of a gang. He wants to be a member of this gang. And then in the last moment, he's even rejected here. One of those who he'd contacted said that he hadn't bothered to answer him because, not because he was extreme, but because he was so boring. And so he's rejected even here. That was January of 2010. The next month in February, that's when he starts to buy the weapons.
Let's talk for just a little bit about July 22nd, 2011, when he killed all these people, 77 people. I mean, first he blew up the government building, hoping to kill the prime minister, killed, what, 8 people there, and then went off to this island where lots of young students were. I mean, he would just walk from one kid to the next, shooting them in the head.
Yeah, he spared no one. And that's when I think this video game mentality comes in. He just shot and left, shot and left, shot and left. Beforehand, he had been calculating how many people he needed to kill to be famous. And to be famous, he wanted to be read, because he wrote that big manifesto and he called the massacre his book launch, because he wanted his manifesto to be read. And he decided that he needed to kill minimum 12 people, and then he ended up killing 77.
What was the hardest part for you in telling the story?
To talk to the parents of these teenagers, because I felt, when I contacted them, I felt that I was intruding into a family, intruding into a grief, and still I knew I had to do it.
Did these families want to talk to you?
Yeah, they did. So how did I choose? Because there's only 3 main families in the book. They kind of chose themselves. So what happened during the trial, there's a very strong guy whose name is Viljar, who's shot 5 times on the island, first in his thigh, in his shoulder, in his arm, and then last through his eye. The doctors don't understand how it's possible. The brain was lying outside of his skull. And then the policeman who came after the massacre, they think he's dead, so they don't take him. And then some policeman comes up to him and he finds this little pulse of this boy. And the policeman was a former soldier from Afghanistan, so he knew this war injuries. So he put the brain back into the skull and patched it together as you would do with a ceramic bowl or something, got him into this boat, taking him over to the other side. There's a helicopter waiting to take him to the hospital. He's in coma for 10 days. And there's one night when he's getting so cold and the doctor's telling the parents, you know, this is the end. But you have one last chance to give him the will to live. He must want to live. Talk to him, cuddle him, do whatever. And then a friend of his is coming and he's talking about, you know, what they will do when they will get out. And at some point, this friend is starting to sing, and he's singing a song that they, you know, sang together. And early morning that, you know, after a long night, the boy in the bed, Viljar, starts to sing along with his friend. That's the start. And this boy now, he is studying psychology at the university now he's on his 3rd year. He's blind on one eye. He doesn't have a shoulder. He can't ski any longer. He can't do all those things that he loved to do before. But that boy was testifying in court. And I was thinking, you know, that boy has to be part of the book. And he went to Utøya with his best friends. There were 3. He was the only one to come back. So his 2 best friends are the 2 other main characters of the book.
Wow, what an amazing story of human resilience.
Yeah, I think it's important in the book that there are, you know, also stories of survival. Yeah, it's dark to get to know Breivik. It's not someone you really would want to get to know. I have to be honest to say, you know, I'm glad that I'm done with him. I'm never going to go back. I don't need to care about it. I'm done with him.
Asna Sejersted's book is One of Us, the story of Anders Breivik and the massacre in Norway. And Steve Paulson talked with her.